Well, that process is repeated on every plane of consciousness. Now, let me ask you a question. Hypothetical question. Hypothetically, we all eat meat, just for this moment. And I'm raising an animal, and I'm very abusive to that animal. God forbid. But I need to pick somebody to be abusive, and better me than you. You know, always blame the teacher. I mean it. That's what teachers are for. Anything goes wrong in your life, blame the teacher. It's probably their fault anyway. So I'm very abusive to this beautiful little lamb. And it takes into its consciousness, as we know animals do, the impression of abuse. And then somebody comes along and says, oh, all these beautiful people at this weekend, I think I'd love to cook them some lamb. And takes my abused lamb and slaughters it, cooks it, and feeds it to us. That lamb, that animal, becomes part of us. Do you think it matters how that lamb was treated? Sure. Elementary, as Sherlock says. Of course it does. Why? Because all of us believe, to greater or lesser degree, that the stuff, let's say, the matter of that lamb holds the impression. And as we innocently interact with that being, we take on some of those impressions of that abused creature. Well, this is where it gets interesting. As we pass through each plane of consciousness, and as we need to give back to that plane whatever we've taken from it to create the body necessary for that plane, and as we bring those bodies, so to speak, to this body, we divest ourselves of the physical body, and it matters how the physical body was treated. And in each succeeding world, we divest ourselves of the stuff of that world. And what do we leave? Not just the stuff, but the impressions that cling to that consciousness. So what does this have to do with those vast angelic vibrations I was just speaking about a moment ago? Well, even there, the soul's returning. And the journey is not one way. Whoever, whatever comes down, goes back, so to speak. As the soul goes through the angelic realms, even this incredible realm of glorification, it still has impressions. Angelic impressions, but impressions of the angelic as tinted by its experience on earth. Earth is the end of the journey. This is as far as you go. It's from here that the journey home begins. And so, the innocent angels coming out of this allegorical sun do take on some of these formed angelic impressions from those angels returning from the earth here. Now, they're not perhaps impressions as you and I might think of them. But nevertheless, there are impressions. And even the angelic world is affected. For those of you who study some of the classical so-called Western, even though they came out of the East, scriptures, you know that there are different types of angels. If you study some of the prophets in the Old Testament, they really enjoy the different kinds of angels. And in the New Testament, Jesus alludes to them, and certainly in Revelation they speak of them, whoever he, she, or they might be. In the Quran, they speak about angels of fire, angels of water, and so on. In the Vedas, they speak about the different angels. So there is an awareness that there are different vibratory beings, let's say, who emerge out of endless love, who begin to have form. And there's some differentiation. Well, what does it come from? It comes from this differentiation of impressions that they carry. Now, because time is short, we don't visit every world. Some visit some visit others. It also is important to note that as you are entering these worlds, we take on different impressions. Some will take some will take others. It is very important to note the soul is God. I said before, the soul is just God in movement. They asked the Prophet Muhammad, what is the soul? He said, the soul is an activity of God. It's God in action, God in movement. What does that mean? Well, now we know those first three abstract whatevers are not moving. They are stillness. Then there's movement. That's the soul. The soul is made up of God. There is no old soul. There is no young soul. Virtue cannot exalt the soul. Sin cannot touch it. Pirzia said it this morning. This is the essence, the very essence of our understanding of the mystical path, is the awareness that the soul is God. Your soul is God. Your soul is not better than anybody's. Your soul is not worse than anybody's. Some people get very upset when I say there are no old souls. That's why I said this thing about whatever you agree with, take in. Whatever you disagree with, just let it slide by and say, oh, that guy's nuts, if you will. Blame the teacher. Always blame the teacher. Why? Because we have a vested interest in believing a certain belief system. The people who believe the strongest that there are old souls, coincidentally, always believe that they're one of them. Must be some law of the universe. But how much more liberating to really understand that the soul is perfection, never born, never dies, cannot be tainted. Just hang on, I'll leave time at the end if you remember for questions. The difficulty is I like questions too much because then I don't have to do any work. And I don't really like to work. So I leave it till the end, so I force myself to work. Then someone should ask, well, what draws these impressions? Why does this soul take this and this soul take this? I mean, why would anyone ever take the impressions of pain? And the answer is, let me rephrase it. There is a simple answer, which if you think about will lead you to the real answer. The soul does not know. It has not journeyed to the level of knowing yet. It's still an abstract, pure being. It has no means of differentiation. You know the word, the Sanskrit word Vivekananda, the great Swami who was the successor of Sri Ramakrishna, Swami Vivekananda? Ananda, many of you know, means bliss, Ananda. Viveka is, in essence, discrimination. But really, Vivekananda means beyond discrimination, the state of the angel. It's The angel has no means. There is no ego. It'll take anything. It doesn't matter. And frankly, it stays in this state. It takes a long while to develop this ego, this small nafs, this small ego. And there's a wonderful story about Adam. Sufis like stories about Adam. They're always making stories about Adam and Eve. They have their own version of the creation myth. It's not in any particular Bible, but it's quite extraordinary. And who is Adam? Well, Adam was the embodiment of all planes of consciousness, the vastness. And because of that, Adam was perfect, was the Insan Kamil, the perfect human being. But because Adam was perfect, Adam was flawed. Because perfection, incompletion, is imperfect. You all know, I hope, the legend, which is actually real, that the great carpet weavers always weave in a mistake on purpose. They do not want to weave a perfect carpet because perfection is the end. Perfection is what the Sufis call Kamal. I said Insan Kamil. Insan, it means human, person. Kamil, perfect. Kamal. Kamal is the state between Jalal and Jamal, between yin and yang, if you will. Kamal is birth. That's great, but Kamal is also death. Kamal is marriage. Kamal is divorce. Kamal is infancy. Kamal is old age. Kamal is noon. Kamal is midnight. Kamal is dawn. Kamal is sunset, and so on. You get the idea. It's that point where the energy just shifts. Kamal is creation, Kamal is destruction. So here's Adam, Insan Kamil, perfect human being. And Allah, representing the stillness, says, now remember, it's all allegory, no truth here at all. Allah says to Adam, go into form. Adam says, whatever you wish, I'll do. Allah says to the angelic realm, put him into form. The angelic realm say, we are your glorification. Whatever you wish, we will do. There is no such thing as not doing. Everything's fine. All of the universes are in harmony. Everything's perfect because no one has any idea what physical form means. Of course everybody's agreeing. Surely, Allah, you want me in physical form, no problem. Then, everybody becomes aware of physicality in a moment. Why? Because time, as we know it, is created. Adam says, I will not disobey Allah, but I cannot go into that. The angels say, we will not disobey Allah, but we cannot put him into that. We don't know how. There's this huge uproar, so to speak. They go back to Allah. What should we do? Allah says, well, of course, you're not looking. The answer is there. They go back. Turmoil again. They go back to Allah. Allah said, you're not looking. The answer is there. Now, they're really perplexed, which the Sufis say is a very necessary state, to be perplexed. It's part of the creative process. And if you look at your life, you'll see you go through that, and wondrous things usually come out of it, if you make it. Not everybody does. And now I'm going to really, take liberties with the story. The third time they go back, and they're perplexed. And they're sitting around, all of them, the angels and Adam, they don't know what to do. One begins to sigh, and one begins to, little by little, out of this comes what? Music. Now I'll get back to the real story. Because the real story is about music. The divine sound. The music is so intoxicating that Adam, in the intoxicated condition, begins to whirl. The angels, in the intoxicated condition, begin to act with absolutely no sense of self. And the next thing that happens is Adam awakens in the human limited form, in the perfect condition. But perfection cannot exist in limitation. The answer is simple. Adam is ready to die. And this is where the story gets interesting. It is then that the first prophetic message is given. It's not that Adam was the first human being, the first to have the awareness. What is the prophetic message? Well, it has to do with Adam's other half. This is why this myth is not usually public, but it's very simple. If you wish to exist, to stay in the Kamal condition, then the oneness must be experienced as the Jalal and the Jamal, as the masculine and the feminine. Otherwise, you exist as the Kamal, which means no existence. The perfection is such, no man, then no woman. No woman, then no man. It's really quite simple. It is not, to my eye, the battle of the sexes, so to speak. It is the battle of the nafs, of the ego. It is surrendering to the reality. No woman can exist without man. No man can exist without woman. And whichever order you wish to put it in is completely unimportant. Because you can change the story to A and B, and there's no emotional charge, but it's the same story. Now, what about the snake? Well, you need to know Sufis love snakes. Sufis love snakes. I forget what the name of that phobia is, but let's call it snakeophobia. Sufis do not have snakeophobia. Now, they might be afraid of the physical snakes, and that's not what I'm talking about. But as a symbol, they love snakes. Why? Because snakes move by vibration. Contraction and expansion. That's how snakes move. Contraction and expansion. Contraction and expansion. It's very symbolic. Plus, if you look at the movement of a snake, which we call an S, if you look at it in a certain way, it's also Allah in Arabic. It's also Shem in Hebrew. That's the movement of the snake. Anyway, so what does the snake mean? The snake means intelligence, cosmic intelligence. What does that mean? It's what we call harmony. It's the understanding that for the perfection to exist, it needs the imperfection of duality. But without harmony, which is the gift of name and form, harmony, awareness, without awareness there is disaster. Why? Because it is the nature of the two to come back into one. It is the nature of the two to come back into one. We're programmed that way. And so men and women who are destined to support each other and actually further the evolution and experience the oneness in two, also have the potentiality to destroy each other by a lack of harmony. We see it in individual relationships, we see it in whole societies. It is a plague on the planet today, unfortunately. And it's not so easy to stamp out this plague without spiritual awareness. Not necessarily religious awareness, spiritual awareness. So, each of our journeys, by the way, each of our journeys is the same at a certain point. We all go, impossible. You can't possibly expect me to go into that. Imagine having cosmic consciousness. Imagine, I've said, your soul is God. Imagine saying to this cosmic consciousness, you're going to go into that and you're going to have to make your insurance payments and get a driver's license. You're going to have to go through relationships and say the wrong things and, you know, and you're going to have physical infirmities. What? You can't be serious. You can't expect me to do that. That life is a cartoon. So we all have a little hesitation. Part of life on earth is learning to overcome the memory of that hesitation. Life is a struggle. If you expect life not to be a struggle, I promise you, you'll be disappointed. The very nature of life is that it is a struggle. And the struggle feeds us. And the struggle, I don't want to say it teaches us, because that again makes a business relationship. The struggle is really the proof of God. Oddly as that may sound. Okay, I think we should maybe take a stretch. I would take a break, but here's the deal. Time is really tight. Now, I don't care if you come back on time or not, but you need to know I'm going to start in 5 minutes, and I know that that's not fair to a lot of bladders, but I feel like we should take a quick break. Anybody's not here, just and you're here, just tell whoever's not here what I said. So the question arose, as I thought it might, well, what about reincarnation? Now, I'll go back to the journey because there's a few things you need to hear, but what about reincarnation? Is it or isn't it? And people usually preface it by saying, now what do Sufis believe? You know, Sufis believe in harmony and understanding. And so if there are two groups that are saying, seemingly saying the opposite of each other, then Sufis just believe that nobody's looked deeply enough. Because everything comes out of one. It cannot come out of two. So, here's what Sufis know. And I also hope tomorrow to cover something about how our journey in really affects who we are, which I'm going to lay the groundwork for right now. After death here, the mind is still filled with impressions of your life here. After death of the body, the mind continues. Now again, don't fight on this, just take it in. The mind is not physical. The only thing that is deposited in the physical world are those substances which are physical. Thoughts are not physical. They're vibrations of the mind. Emotions are not physical. Even certain, let's say, truth is not physical. Which thoughts do you take with you? Do you take every thought that you're thinking that moment? What goes? We take with us unfinished impressions. What does that mean? Every thought, every impression is just like you. It has a birth, childhood, youth, middle age, old age, and death. That's the natural process of thought. Sometimes that journey takes what appears to us to be 1 second. Sometimes that journey can take our whole life. Depends on the thought and the nature of it. But we are a repository of unfinished impressions. Some we can consciously finish by our actions. If I go to somebody and say, I apologize, that's a wonderful action. Why? Not only is it polite and everything, but more often than not, it brings an end to that impression. There's the release. We don't have to carry it anymore. Many of you know that we carry impressions in our physical body. Many impressions in our posture. We carry it in our cells. Every cell carries impressions. There are certain physical things we can do to release impressions. So if you go to a spa and have a lovely mud bath and you get out and you feel, oh, great. Why? Because you've let stuff go. The mud, we know it. It just pulls things out, not just physical things, not just poisons. Even though, what are toxins? Toxins are the perfume of toxic thoughts, toxic feelings. You know, I can tell how I'm doing at any moment by how I smell. I can just smell myself. I can tell what's going on. No. So when we die here, we carry with us many or few or no impressions. Each of these impressions has a certain rate of vibration. Some are of this very kind of psychic, dense, dark impressions. And I'll tell you a story. Do most of you know who Pir Vilayat Khan is? Yeah? Anybody not know? Shall I? Okay. Well, Pir Vilayat, my good fortune, has been my teacher for a long time. I guess 37 years. And years ago, we were discussing abortion and this topic about the soul after death. And I said, well, what happens to the soul, the spirit actually, as it passes through the psychic realm, the astral realm, and has to deal with all of this stuff? And he said, well, I don't know. I said, what do you mean you don't know? This was on a ride to the airport. I'm driving in traffic in New York City. He said, I'm too pure. I never get stuck there. So I had to find out for myself. The answer is learning. That we go towards that which we focus on in this world. If we focus on a very kind of dark, emotional, egocentric world, that's what the psychic plane is. If we don't focus on it, we don't have much interaction with it. This does not mean that you don't look at your shadow. I wish it were that simple. do have to. Uh-oh. My dear friend Timothy went to get me something hot to drink, and he's got a whole pitcher of coffee. Why don't you just give it to me straight in the arm? Thanks, Tim. That which we focus on pays a great deal of import into what our afterlife becomes. So it's said very beautifully in the scriptures, where your treasure is, there your heart is also. For those who treasure the accumulation of material wealth, they'll go to a world that is defined by that, so to speak, because the world is not outside of us. The world is created by what's in our minds. Anything that is unfinished must be deposited on that particular plane of consciousness in order for us to die once again to that plane and to be born into the next. So, for many people, it comes as a bit of a shock when I say, look, you're not going to necessarily meet your relatives. But they say, well, what about all of these stories of people dying and seeing their mother or something like that? And the answer is, what the mind dwells on, that's the world it creates. So for those who believe that the next world will be made of the interaction with their relatives, they will have that interaction. Is it your relatives? Well, you can interpret it any way you wish. If you will accept that your mother is a being of your creation, of the creation of your mind, then yes, you're meeting your mother. Nobody stays anywhere forever. Yes, I certainly can. Sorry. Is this a hallucinatory effect that the mind has after death, which will eventually dissipate, I'm paraphrasing now, and you go on to the next world? And everything that we experience, in a sense, is a hallucination, including this right here. I know I'm hallucinating all of you. It is a dream. That's the best way to say it. The difference between that dream and the dream you dream at night is when you dream at night, your consciousness knows, I'm going to wake up. If you dream at night, if I dream at night and I don't like the dream, I just wake myself up. If I don't do that, I change the dream. You can do the second, but you can't do the first. You're not going to wake up. You can change with training. You can change the dream. But you're not going to wake up. And once the consciousness knows that you're not going to wake up, the whole game has changed. Because there's a part of us that now can say, no matter what happens, well, it was only a dream. But from these dreams, you do not wake up. This state is gone. Hopefully. I'll talk about when the state isn't gone. That's really a mess. But I said that I was going to say something about reincarnation. And you have enough background now that I can say this. The soul is a mirror. The soul has no intelligence because it has all intelligence. It has no egocentricity. The soul is God. The soul is a mirror that not only reflects and gives life to whatever is put in front of it, but believes that it is that. So, the classic example that the Sufis always give is the following. And it was even picked up by different philosophers, Gatta among them. There's a very poor young man who has been not excommunicated, disowned by his family. And he's living on the streets. He doesn't have a dime. Doesn't know from day to day if he's going to live or die. unbeknownst to him, his parents have a change of heart. How could we do that to our son? Unbeknownst to him, because they can't find him anymore, they change their will. And upon their death, which occurs, there is this vast fortune deposited in a bank waiting for this young man. Then they ask the question, is the young man rich or is the young man poor? If you ask him, he's poor. If you see the totality, he's quite wealthy. So it is with the soul. The soul believes that it is whatever is put in front of it. If we know how to put itself in front of it, the soul recognizes its infinite condition. But it's not so easy to do that. In the interim, we put all kinds of things in front of the soul. The soul believes it is that. I always tell people who work with me on a one-to-one basis, you know, and I've worked with some people for decades. One of the most dangerous tendencies is the desire to be immortal. Because we wish to take that which by nature is mortal and make it immortal, and we wish to use the mortal to find the immortal. And it's impossible because the mortal keeps placing mortality in front of the immortal mirror. If we give up the desire that this entity be immortal, we will discover immortality. Because then we're placing the immortal before the immortal. It will see itself. Reincarnation. These impressions are discarded as this spirit goes through every level of consciousness. Why do I say spirit and not soul? Because soul is really this untouched state, but in movement. But in that untouched state, there is somehow intelligence, cosmic intelligence. That's what spirit is. It is soul that knows it exists. Pure soul really can't know it exists. It's in those first three. The movement comes from the divine intelligence manifesting in soul. We'll discuss that more. Anyway, the soul is coming in to manifestation. In each of these planes, it takes on impressions. Remember, it does not have the ability to discriminate. It will take on the unfinished impressions of a murderer as soon as it will of a saint. It doesn't matter to the soul. It sees only unity. So then why are some souls take this and some, how does it work? Certainly there must be some order. There is. There's something called the law of attraction and repulsion, but it doesn't exist on this plane. It is not possible to understand this law from the viewpoint of this plane. Another word for it is divine justice. But human beings, when they talk about divine justice to human beings is whatever they want it to be. Whatever they believe, if that happens, that's divine justice. Because we don't see connectedly. We only see usually unilaterally. So some souls attract some impressions and some others. So being a creature of habit, I always use the same example. Here's this soul coming in, and here's this other soul coming in. And they pass through the plane of mind, and there are the unfinished impressions of Beethoven. One soul takes on the impressions of the music. One soul takes on the impressions of the drinking problem. Both souls incarnate. Which one is Beethoven? Truth is neither. They're just impressions that incarnate again and again until they reach a state of rest. But if the one who has the music happens to hear a lot of people say, gosh, you know, that's just like Beethoven's music. You must be a reincarnation of Beethoven. Whereas the one with the drinking problem never hears anybody say, hey, you have the same problem as Ludwig. So the one with the music seems to think it's a reincarnation of Beethoven. So Sufis, what do they believe? Do they believe in reincarnation or don't they? People always say, oh, you Sufis, you're just going all over the place. Do you or don't you? Black or white? What is it? And we always say yes. If you believe that these impressions come in again and again, and if I can identify some of these impressions and they affect my life deeply, then yes, I'm the reincarnation of those impressions, but my soul is not. If you believe that reincarnation has to do with the soul, and the soul just comes in once, then you don't believe in reincarnation. But really, if you understand the process, if someone says, do you believe in reincarnation, the wisest answer is to ask them, do you? And whatever they say, agree with, because both are true. Impressions do incarnate again and again. Then somebody always asks me, well, what about the tulkus? You know, the Rinpoches or the Dalai Lama who can reincarnate. There is a practice, and I must say Sufis know this practice as well, where if you prepare before death, at death, you can keep most of the impressions collected and pass them on to an incoming soul almost in a complete package. That's how that works. So it would be easy for me if I'm incarnating and have a complete package and someone says, can you pick out your coffee cup from these 50 coffee cups? It would be easy to remember which one is mine because I have all of the impressions. I did not let certain memories finish purposely, or I should say the previous depositor of impressions purposely kept certain things intact, did not let them go to rest, so that when the next soul comes in, they get an almost complete package. Why? Not so they can know their prayer beads and coffee cups, but there is some teaching that it just takes so many souls, so many incarnations to bring to a state of completion. So now you know the secret. So the next soul is not you? Well, which, as Ramana Maharshi said, who are you? How are you defining you? Are you this body? The next soul is not this body. Are you this mind? Well, parts of that mind are going to come back. Are you this soul that you're placing these images in front of? That soul is not coming back, no. And what happens to that soul? That soul gradually releases form until it becomes abstract consciousness with no sense of self and goes back into the infinite. The three from which we started, those three levels of unconsciousness, so to speak.
So the question is about the soul's evolution. So now if I'm getting this now, that's how the soul doesn't evolve. It's like the impressions evolve or the spiritual intelligence evolves. What is evolution then? That's the question. What evolves?
Yes. I'm going to give you an answer that you can do with what you wish. What evolves is God. understand that the vast, if, now this is absurd to say, but I'm going to say it, the vast majority of God does not exist in time or space. Any time or any space. So obviously that can't evolve. It is unchanging, unknowable. Beyond the mystery, frankly. That doesn't evolve. And remember, your soul is God. So what evolves? God in manifestation. And you can do with that what you wish. I can't go further than that. You can put different names on it. Some people call it consciousness. You might enjoy reading aloud to yourself or to your friends the Tibetan Book of Great Liberation by Guru Rinpoche, by Padmasambhava. It's a short treatise that was written almost 1,000 years ago. And I like myself the Evans-Wentz translation, but you can find others. Evans-Wentz. It's hyphenated. But in that, he said at the very end, blessed disciples, in essence, I'm not giving you this teaching now, I'm giving it for the disciples who are going to come in 1,000 years. And that, if we're lucky, that might be us. And he speaks about consciousness. And he speaks about that which changes and that which doesn't. And it is quite interesting to read, not to study, but to read aloud. That's why I said I really don't like to talk for 2 hours. I'd much rather do spiritual practice. But I don't know how to get this understanding across without words. I'm just not good enough at it. And we could, but I'm going to do something even better. Blasphemy that it is. I'm going to recommend a book, which we'll talk about more tomorrow. And I asked them to get this in the bookstore. Someone said, is this your book? Well, I own it, but I didn't write it. This is a book by Inayat Khan, Hazrat Inayat Khan. It used to be called The Soul Whence and Whither. It's now called The Soul's Journey. It's been re-edited. Some of the things in it were not accurate transcriptions of what he said. And there are other things that were not published before that are in it now. It is, I just bought one, it's 17 bucks. And anything and everything that I speak of is in this book. Now, not in the way that I speak of it. But what he did was he gave a series of talks in a summer school every day at 5:30 for a half an hour. And went and did just what we did today, went into the consciousness of the soul, of the spirit, of impressions. And it's a wonderful, wonderful book to have and to read slowly. And I don't usually recommend books. I'm kind of laughing because in this session I recommended 3, which is more than I probably have done all year. So I find that interesting. But and I don't get a cut from the bookstore. I just really think that these books are important. One more thing, and then we have to end. This is not a way of thinking that many of us have grown up with. It takes a bit of work to absorb. You can accept it. Accepting it is easy, but to absorb it so that it becomes part of you takes a little work, because it's not about understanding, it's about spiritual experience. Until you understand that the mind, the thinkingness, I should say, is just a function of the heart, it's very difficult to discipline the thinkingness. Now, this is a different topic, but don't try and get it on the thinkingness level. Try and go a little deeper right from the beginning and just drink it in little sips. Tomorrow, I also will talk about souls that, for one reason or another, and I'll give some of the reasons, don't wish to continue the journey. And the mess that they create, speaking clearly, frankly, I don't know if it's clear, but frankly. At the same time, the greatest beings around are these beings that have taken this bodhisattvic vow. And their vow is, I won't continue into the nothingness until all feeling beings have completed their motion. I will stay and help. So you don't have to go to the nothingness. You can stay and create havoc, or you can stay and create heaven. Oh, and if somebody reminds me, I will say something about heaven and hell, too. Is it enough? It's very rich food. It really is very, very rich food. Maybe if you can sit for about another 120 seconds, we should do some practice just to bring this into us. I don't like ending. And I can't move my right leg anyway, so we have to. If you come in a half an hour, I think Kabir and maybe Katiba and I are going to supposedly give you an introduction to the zikr. But let's do zikr anyway, without the introduction. I don't think you need to hear so much. All we're saying, literally we're saying, nothing exists save the one. But how can, I mean, literal meanings in a sense, after what we've just heard, mean nothing. But we're working with sound. Sound is the vibration made manifest. What sound? Ah, la, ilaha illallah. Coincidentally, that sound is deeply connected to the heart chakra, the heart center. So all we're going to do is take all of this voluminous information that I shared, and we're going to root it into our hearts. Doesn't matter if you don't know the words, just hum along. If you want to be silent, that's fine. This is not what it's about. If you wish to do the head movement, the head moves from the left shoulder across the kind of arcs across the chest and out the right shoulder when we say La ilaha, and into the physical heart on the left as we say Illallah. La ilaha.